Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan present Point Taken, a podcast connecting you to the sports and pop culture issues you care about and the guests you want to hear more from. Now, here's Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady.
Big surprise for you. Big surprise. I didn't say it was a good surprise. No Carolyn Cameron. Not ever again. Don't flood with emails, tweets, texts, Snapchat requests. None of that. Carolyn Cameron will be back next week, 2 weeks away. I was told originally, I'm not going to say by who, Carolyn, not to really mention or make a big deal about where she was going. And then I just happened to be watching Sportsnet Central. And there's a picture of her posted on the, like, it's a really important time in sports. We got a lot going on, baseball playoffs, NFL games, NHL games starting, NBA preseason well underway. Toronto FC wins the Supporters' Shield. I can keep going. There's a million, all the sports are happening at once. Name me a sport that's in their offseason right now. We're headed that way with tennis, I suppose. But name me a sport that's in their offseason. There isn't one. And they found time within a 15, 20-second span of, you know, 43, 44 minutes of programming to isolate a picture of Carolyn Cameron on vacation. Now, I'm not going to say where. I'm not going to say we'd like to keep an element of mystery. I've told Carolyn she should be more mysterious. No, less mysterious. Not more. Less mysterious. But the irony of that comment might be lost on her. But we welcome her back next week. We'll be happy that she will be back, and we'll be deeper into October. As we record this, want to remind you that we are available on iTunes. You might be listening to us on iTunes or Google Play on your Android or SoundCloud, any particular option. But please feel free to rate the podcast. That's how we know how we're doing. That's how we know what you want, and that's how we know how to provide it on the Point Taken podcast. I'm very excited that we're going to now, for different reasons, but we're going to talk to Rob Tannenbaum, who is a music journalist who I've enjoyed for a long, long time. He's written for Rolling Stone before. He's written for Playboy. I guess technically he's a Hugh Hefner employee. Should we ask him a Hugh question? Is there an obligatory Hugh question that's a good question? But he's written for the New York Times, GQ, Billboard. And with the passing of 66-year-old Tom Petty this week, rock and roll, and I think pop music also. Let's not forget they can be two similar things and two different things. Loses yet another icon. We all know how rough 2016 was. You name it. We lost that person, it felt like. Leonard Cohen, Prince, David Bowie, Glenn Frey. And Prince, Bowie, and Frey, not to dismiss anything about Leonard Cohen, who's one of probably our three, four, five greatest songwriters ever. I always put him on a pedestal with Neil Young, Tom Cochran, Joni Mitchell. I've got my favorite Canadian songwriters. You probably do as well. But Bowie and Prince especially, left a tremendous legacy with me, still remarkably influenced me, pleased me, if you will. Pleasured sounds wrong, but pleased me with what they brought musically. Saw them both multiple times. And Glenn Frey as a member of the Eagles. The Eagles are going to go out on tour later in October with their Glenn's son, Deacon Frey, which is controversial to some. I'm not a fan of this in sports either. Hey, you should quit. Hey, you're not good enough anymore. You should quit. I understand if you want teams to move off a player because there's salary implications, whether there's a salary cap or just a luxury tax. I understand that you don't want him on your team, but I always found it strange. It's, hey, you've been successful. Now I don't think you should be anymore, and please leave the thing that makes you happiest. It's a really tough thing to do. And as we know with musicians and mostly actors, all of a sudden you'll see an actor or you'll come across an old movie and you'll be like, Gene Hackman. Love Gene Hackman, who I think is now 87 or 88 years old. And I think the first film I ever saw him in as a kid was as Lex Luthor in Superman. And he made a ton of movies after that. Mississippi Burning, the Alan Parker film about civil unrest in Mississippi with Willem Dafoe in it also. Is one of my favorite movies. It's one of my favorite movies. And I loved Alan Parker directing The Wall, the Pink Floyd biopic. Well, the Pink Floyd album movie with Bob Geldof as Pink. But Gene Hackman, then you go back and you see him in The Conversation, and you say to yourself, why doesn't he make movies anymore? Well, he just doesn't. But he didn't hold a big news conference and say, I'm retiring from movies. You just kind of fade away, as opposed to the burnout philosophy, right? It's Neil Young's song. So, but we're losing more and more important artists in the world of music. And to lose Tom Petty, what I noticed right away, and the reason I knew I wanted to talk to Rob about it in a little bit, is simply put, because we are getting to the point. We're getting to the point where we are going to lose a lot of these people, and quickly, because of the age of rock and roll when it started and when certain artists peaked, and the fact that it's been proven, and we weren't even sure 25 years ago that you could remain relevant and popular and do what you do. And obviously the check's clear, and they're nice checks, deep into your 60s. We didn't. We thought the Stones, I remember the Steel Wheels tour came along. The Stones hadn't toured since maybe the early 80s, maybe on the Tattoo U tour. And they made a couple albums, Undercover and Dirty Work. And Mick Jagger did some solo work that Keith Richards wasn't terribly happy about. And they simply got back together in 89. And stories were around that were very much, oh my goodness, are the Rolling Stones too old? It's funny to think about now. Mick Jagger was 46. Keith Richards was also in his 40s. I know he didn't look it, but on the Steel Wheels tour, Keith Richards was 47 and Mick Jagger was 46. And now we giggle at the notion that that would be too old to go on tour and play rock and roll for 2 hours. And Tom Petty just finished a 40th anniversary tour with the Heartbreakers, with three sold-out shows at LA's Hollywood Bowl. And then passed away on Monday afternoon after going into cardiac arrest on Sunday night. He was 66. He left an amazing legacy. We'll talk to Rob Tannenbaum in just a little bit about it. On a more, I wouldn't even know if it's a personal note, but SportsCent 590 The Fan had its 25th anniversary party on Monday. And you may, if you listen to the station, you've been hearing vignettes and memories from current and past on-air staff. And I did want to reflect on it and say what a remarkable story it is. And the reason I say that is because radio is so personal to me, and it's changed so much. And the things that it does now, maybe I always think things were better than they used to be. Maybe I think that with music and sports and salaries and television, and that's not true because we have HD television now. Imagine if all of a sudden HD TV went away. We'd be devastated. All of a sudden, everything's in low def, what they'd call standard def. But I love radio so much. And the first radio that was in my room as a kid, I was probably 6 years old. And I made it a priority to put radios in my kids' rooms. They're 11 and 9 now, and there's a radio in there. And I want that on. I'll go into their rooms and turn the radio on. And they can listen to what they want to. They want to listen to the station I'm on, which is rare. I mean, we're not really huge with 9-year-olds at Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I feel that if they did studies, they would find that we are not as big as we could potentially be, or that we ever have been. But I do want a scenario where they grow up and they appreciate radio. God knows in the car now, they dictate what we listen to when I'm with them in a motorized vehicle. I don't get my choice anymore. And I have Sirius for music. I love music. That's quite obvious. And Sirius I've had for 13 years. And I'm not allowed to quite listen to what I want to like I used to be able to anymore. But the anniversary party was at the Pint on Front Street, which is a great new place that used to be a Baton Rouge restaurant. And I think I went there a couple times before. I went there before a Bills and Toronto game once, maybe twice. I think the year the Bills got blown out by Seattle, and that guy did Gangnam Style. Psy? C? Whatever his name was. I think it was Psy. Anyway, it's now the Pint, and so you go there, and you just see the history involved. And it's those kind of pinch-yourself moments. I wish there could have been a few more listeners there, but it was remarkable. And to see people that are such a part of a station's history, 25 years is an awfully long time. And so if they've been part of it, Eric Smith has been part of The Fan for 17 years. Dave Cadeau, my program director, our program director, has been a part of it, I think, combined for over 15. And then there's obviously Bob, who I shook hands with and said, 40 years, that's amazing. And of course, that the joke might have gotten lost on him, but I'm not 100% sure. He's pretty he's quicker than he pretends to be with me. That's for damn sure. And again, I've always talked about how in awe of what Bob's accomplished in this business. I have been. And he's done it through some things that have been very conventional and some things that have been very unconventional. But I have great admiration for his work. And it was so much fun because you think about the Toronto sports fan and what we're waiting on. And I didn't live here during the 92 and 93 World Series teams winning, but I lived down the road and was at Western. So homecoming night, both those Saturday nights in Atlanta at Fulton County Stadium in 92. And home against the Philadelphia Phillies, both game sixes. You don't win. There's a game seven the very next night. And we don't remember a lot about what those game sevens would have felt like. The great concern was Curt Schilling would pitch for the Phillies on 2 days rest. 2 days rest for the Phillies. And there wasn't going to be a rainout, right? Like what happened in 86 with the Mets and Boston when after the Bill Buckner era on the Saturday night, game six got rained out and Boston was able to go back to Bruce Hurst instead of oil can Boyd pitching. Little things like that I end up remembering. But when we think about what we're hoping we're on the edge of with the Toronto Maple Leafs and what we might be right on the edge of right now in the next couple months with Toronto FC, who are a shootout goal at a timely moment away from being defending MLS champions and are so fun to watch. And after 7 years of pure and utter hell under terrible management with terrible administration and terrible coaching and some terrible players, they've really found their way, and their supporters have been just absolutely on cloud nine watching this team for the better part of a year and a half. People forget they made the playoffs at the end of the 15 season. But being at this was really incredible, and I have so many idols in the broadcast world, and I probably don't express it because it just sounds very fanboyish, pardon the pun, or pardon the phrase, and I guess it's partly a pun. But what a good time Monday night was. And to be off work for a year without going into all the specifics of it and then come back and be colleagues with so many of these people again. Not everyone's gonna love you. Not everyone's going to end up being best friends. No workplace is like that. But to see so many of these people that I admire and adore and am close to and I'm pleased to be on the same team with, it was an amazing night. That was the struggle. In a year off, I had a good time playing music at home and eating a lot of scrambled eggs and waking up at 8:30 in the morning and going to the gym whenever I felt like it and getting a lot of sun. But when I couldn't find anything else I wanted to do career-wise, A, that was disturbing, and B, it was reassuring at the same time. So to come back and be part of the station's amazing legacy is remarkable, because everywhere you go in North America, people have heard of this station and they can name a few shows that they've liked in the past. And again, not everyone's going to get universal approval for their show or who they are as a personality and how they mixed with another personality. But it was a lot of fun being there, a ton of fun being there. Again, it was kind of a sad moment walking up to the pint for the 25th anniversary. I'm going to talk about Cam Newton a little later on in the show because I did want to get to that. So there is more on that and the comments he made to a reporter in Charlotte in a post-practice media conference on Wednesday. But Tom Petty passed away at the age of 66. Writing about him in Billboard will be Rob Tannenbaum, who, again, an excellent music critic, has written for many, many a publication, and you'll be able to read what he writes about Tom in Billboard online. I think it's an online exclusive. We'll find out more about it early next week. We're very pleased to welcome in author and music critic. You may know his book, and it's now in paperback. I bought it when it was hardcover, when it was cool to buy it. I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution. You've also read him before in Rolling Stone, Billboard Right Now. We'll talk about that. And he lists on his Twitter bio, Playboy. Has anyone asked you about the passing of Hugh Hefner? Someone must have brought it up to you at least in the last 9 days, correct?
A couple of people have asked me about it, and you know, I know why people don't exactly entirely mourn Hefner's death. All I can say is the magazine treated me really well.
But I think it was universal. I saw in this day and age where you think, oh my goodness, we must point out any semblance of something that is sexist. I thought there were a lot of tributes for Hugh about the First Amendment. I thought there were a lot of tributes about how he was as a publisher, how he, you know, how he was sort of a shy, reticent guy, beyond the bathrobe and the bunny costumes.
Yeah.
And the grotto, you know.
He certainly has a complicated and mixed legacy. When he died, I saw a lot of end of an era tweets. Mm-hmm. And really, I might try to write this piece. We live in the era of end of an era. There are so many eras that are dying around us. When Prince died, when Bowie died, Rolling Stone is on the verge of moving to once a month publication. They'll make half as many issues per year. And certainly when Hefner died, it's the end of an era.
Well, you're going to write about Tom Petty, and that made me think at the start, because 2016 was this annus horribilis, as the Queen might say, this awful year of losing iconic people. And I was starting to lament that, especially because I think we had Bowie, Fry, and Prince all within about a three-month span. And someone who's 10 years younger, who I don't consider as a worldly, if you will, Rob, said to me, won't this happen for your generation every year from here on in? And you're kind of getting at that, because we didn't have, when you and I were in our teens, and say when MTV started, we really didn't have old rock stars. Like, we'd look and go, are the Stones really going on tour? They're in their mid-40s. And now we don't, like, Coldplay's in their mid-40s, and we're like, yeah, that's what they do. Of course they should, right?
I think that's right, and just about everyone who was a baby boomer, if a baby boomer was born in, 70 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those people are starting to get old and die, and so much of the ongoing culture of America, maybe Canada too, I don't know, is still dominated by baby boomers. The modern contemporary culture was created by baby boomers, who were so voluminous that marketers, advertisers continue to appeal to them. To the point, honestly, where a lot of times because I'm not a baby boomer, I'm just like, could you guys just shut up and go away already? I'm tired of hearing about your glory days. But then somebody like Petty dies, and you go back and listen to his albums, and you think, well, all right, you guys really knew what you were doing.
Well, I went through a span, I think 4 weeks ago, I decided, and you might appreciate this story, being a father also, I take my kids to the Joshua Tree tour in the summer, and they're 11 and 9, and the 9-year-old was fine with it, and the 11-year-old thought it was too loud, and he was just bugging me to go. By the time, like, One Tree Hill or so rolls around, so I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to miss the last couple songs of the album, and I'm going to miss the entire encore, which is exactly how it played out. And they started late. It was a Friday night. They wanted Pure Darkness, as you know, in June in Toronto or New York. It doesn't get dark till about 10:02 nowadays. So all that happened. So I'm like, I'm going to go to Buffalo to see them. So I go with a friend and go to the big state NFL stadium in Buffalo. And then I also see Depeche Mode here in Toronto within about a three-day span. So that's a lot for me to get to two gigs in four nights in my mid-40s. But I thought, are we going to run out, and you tell me if you think we will, are we going to run out of acts that do have 25, 30-year careers? Even as, I don't want to call Depeche Mode pedestrian, because their fans are really hardcore. They've always had a great European support system, and even though they wouldn't have had a hit single in a long, long time, they're always going to come to your town and sell 18,000 tickets. But are we going to run out of those artists who have 30-35 year, album/tour/album/tour careers, do you think?
Well, I'd say yes and no. Even looking at Petty, who had a pretty remarkable career, his commercial peak really starts with Damn the Torpedoes in 79 and ends with, either Into the Great Wide Open in 91. No, let's say 96. Mm-hmm. Let's say he had a 16, 17-year chart run, which is pretty astounding. But he didn't stop making records. His album run, and if you love all of his albums, you're impressed by this, was, but let me see if I can do the math quickly, almost 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So do I think Justin Bieber will be making hits 15 years from now? I don't think so. I think there's a churn now in our culture that we didn't have in the past, or maybe we did, let's say, pre-Beatles, which is probably where Andy Warhol got the idea of, in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. Until the Beatles, there wasn't really such a thing as a pop or rock music career. So I think that there will still be, you know, great bands that make records for 30 years, the Drive-By Truckers. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, unless they break up, I don't think they're ever going to stop making great records. I think that there's now a greater discrepancy between pop and rock, where top 40 acts churn constantly. If you're 16, you don't want the same act that your 20-year-old brother listened to. And on the other hand, rock acts will continue to make albums and have to tour because the albums don't sell.
Yeah, yeah. And it's because the album chart and the singles, a hit single is so different. I've got the opportunity to look it up. So Petty puts out Hypnotic Eye in 14. It goes to number one, not a hint of a hit single. So you can have now a top 10 album because all the fans of his, all the devotees will go get a Tom Petty album, might even get a John Mellencamp or a Bob Seger new release if there was to be one. But you won't hear those songs on conventional radio like we always used to, quite obviously.
Yeah, and that's the reason a number one album isn't that impressive anymore. You know, again, when you and I were kids, Dark Side of the Moon was on the top 200 for, 8 years in a row, 10 years in a row, something astounding, or Fleetwood Mac's Rumors. A number one album oftentimes would sell 6, 7, 8 million records. Nowadays, you sell 80 to 120,000 copies in the first week, and you get your number one album, and then it just starts to plummet. But this also brings us back a little bit to baby boomers. If you look at not just tour schedules, but whatever the big venue is in Toronto or Montreal or the Sheds, it's full of baby boomer acts now. This isn't because they're 70, 75, 68 years old and are dying to get in a tour bus and have to pull in into a Denny's every time they need to take a crap. It's because this is the only way they can make money. The records aren't selling. Old records aren't selling. And, you know, if you've seen David Crosby on Twitter go on a rant about Spotify, the economics of it are not as good for artists. You know, sidebar, they're better than David Crosby thinks they are, but we can do a different podcast on that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. They want, and I'll tell you, there's been some elasticity with concert ticket prices where it doesn't seem to matter. I'm sure there's a point where someone would say, well, I'm not going to go see Sting this time around, or I'm not going to go see Springsteen, but we haven't hit it. I mean, we don't see a turn back of the audience. We don't see that with movies, too. I always think that about the cinema, where there's just something so special about it, and people go there on dates. And no matter how good your home, we used to go to the movies, right? Because we had a crappy TV at home and we didn't have access to hundreds of movies with the flick of a button. So we'd go, but now people still go in huge numbers to, no matter how nice their basement is, with a 50-inch TV and surround sound, don't they?
Do we just sound like old men, or are we old men?
It's 50-50. It's a little bit of both. With Tom Petty, I've realized in 48 hours since he passed away that I may have even underestimated his appeal. I always saw Bruce, obviously, at the top of this sort of Heartland Rock Mountain. And Heartland's not fair because Tom's almost identified specifically with Florida, where he grew up, or California, where he moved to. I mean, Free Fallin's all California. But I saw Bruce there, and then you'd have Petty and Mellencamp and Seeger, and even our own Bryan Adams attempted those mountains for several years before with a Robin Hood song. And then he seemed to like only ballads. But anyway, did I even undersell Tom being on that level with Mellencamp and Seeger, or did he even go beyond that for some people?
Well, to me, he's well beyond Mellencamp, even before I started to think about him in retrospect. I saw Springsteen more. Springsteen meant more to me. There was probably a time in my life where I thought of Petty as just certainly secondary to Springsteen, in a similar vein, but secondary to him. And what I realized after he died, and I went back and started listening to the albums again, I had been dismissing him because his albums, you know, except for Damn the Torpedoes and Hard Promises, his albums usually had two or three great singles and then a lot of filler. So I thought of Petty as a guy who every couple of years wrote, made a B-plus album. But after a while, you know, after 20 years of making B-plus albums, you have to tip your cap and say, okay, you know, he was a singles artist. He was probably more of a singles artist than Springsteen was.
Mm-hmm.
Springsteen was better at making albums. But, and I don't mean to, I know that this is going to come out sounding kind of grudging. You have to tip your hat to a guy who, for 20 years, can make really high-quality songs. I think the comparison with Seeger is a good one, although, because Seeger is underrated. You know, the difference is Seeger kind of gave up, or at least stopped trying, and is badly in need of reissuing the stuff he made before the Silver Bullet Band, which is, you know, just fantastic,
right,
but not organized anywhere and extremely difficult to find. Petty, I never thought to myself, oh shit, Tom Petty is in town. I can't wait to go see him. But I should have. And I regret that I didn't, especially when Stan Lynch was the drummer in the band, which I think was the peak era of Tom Petty. So to go back and directly answer your question, I think a lot of people did kind of underrate him because for so long he was in the shadow of Springsteen, if you viewed him solely in that vein.
Yeah. I always find entry points fascinating. The first Stone song I ever heard on the radio was Start Me Up, because I started listening to the radio when I was 9 years old in 1981. And then you go back. The first Who song I ever heard was You Better You Bet, and that's the same year. And I love that song. And so that has special meaning, even when you go back and go, oh, this Who's Next album is pretty amazing, you know? So, but Petty has so many different ones, I find. And I don't even know that it's all based on age. I'd never heard Refugee or Don't Do Me Like That when I first heard The Waiting, which was the first song on the 1981's that big year. But I know people 10 years younger than me discovered him with Full Moon Fever, and 15 years later discovered him with Wildflowers. He has so many points in which someone fell in love with something amazing he was doing.
It's like the joke about the guy who goes to see Wings and says, McCartney was in a band before Wings? The thing about Petty, though, was even in different guises, he always sounded like Petty. He recorded with the Heartbreakers. He recorded what were ostensibly solo albums, although they almost always had Heartbreakers on them. Traveling Wilburys. Mudcrutch. I was listening to Mudcrutch yesterday, which I hadn't done very much. It's a Tom Petty record.
That's right. Yeah.
I don't care what the name is on the front. That's Tom Petty. And again, I think that's another reason, another distinction with Springsteen that kind of worked against Petty by comparison. Springsteen moved in different guises a lot. You know, if he were a woman, we'd say he reinvented himself. For some reason, we say that about Madonna, but we don't say it about Springsteen. I remember hearing Hungry Heart on the radio, and the DJ said, well, that's the new song from Bruce Springsteen. That is not Bruce Springsteen singing. Why are you lying to me? And it was Springsteen singing. Petty, nearly so.
Yeah.
You knew it was Tom Petty's voice within two notes.
And somehow, critically, you're right. I don't think the critics... Though I think he had his moments. I want to talk about that sort of, not that the mid-80s were sort of a down period for him. I like a lot of stuff from there, but you're right in that the audience knew and his fans knew and the Top 40 radio audience knew that's what he was going to give them. Whereas take the two artists we were talking about earlier in our chat, Bowie and Prince, constant, as you would call it, reinvention. And if you liked this David Bowie album, you might not like the next one because he's going to do something totally different. I didn't like when Prince started having rappers join him around 1992. Sure. I'm like, no, I want more Sign of the Times, and I want more, I want more Love Sexy, and I want more of that. And Prince and Bowie would never give you the same thing for too very long, would they? Tom Petty did.
And that's where the phrase "damn the torpedoes" really keeps coming back to me. Petty, he was famous for feuding with his record company. He picked a fight with them before his third album, "Damn the Torpedoes." Then he picked another fight with them before "Hard Promises," his next record. You could not move him off of a rock. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, and I won't back down. That wasn't just a lyric. That was his credo. And he wasn't a chest beater. He wasn't heroic. There are probably a lot of Petty fans who don't know the story of Hard Promises. A record company wanted to raise the price of his album, and he wouldn't let them. There was a lawsuit before Damn the Torpedoes where he said to the record company, "If you don't renegotiate my contract, I'll go sell peanuts." And there's a great story in the Peter Bogdanovich documentary where Petty is in a meeting with the lawyers, and he takes out a penknife and he starts cleaning underneath his fingernails, which is such a cowboy Western gangster move. Petty was as stubborn as anyone in the history of rock and roll. Once he found something he liked, he stuck with it. Why should he change his musical style? It's good music.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There wasn't an album where you're like, oh, what a left field turn, what a change of direction for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. There must have been fans, and I don't know the answer to this, even from reading a lot about Petty and being so curious about him, not just this week, obviously. I can't tell if there were fans that sort of had that moment, even with Full Moon Fever, where they're like, wait a minute, where are the Heartbreakers? What's with the guy from ELO? What's with his new boyfriend there producing all the songs? Because the singles were so damn good. Maybe that's the case. You start an album with I Won't Back Down, and then you roll Running Down a Dream, and then you roll with Free Fallin'. You'd mentioned that about singles with Springsteen. Even with Born in the USA success, you got a tough time finding, or Mellencamp or Seeger, you got a tough time finding an album that can roll singles 1 through 3 like that, that everybody knows, that have been played millions of times on radio stations.
I think the exception that we were just discussing about Petty always being Petty is the Southern Accents album. I remember when Don't Come Around Here No More came out, and it had that weird, which sounded like a sitar, may have been a sitar or a guitar treated to sound like a sitar, and he was working with Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics. Mm-hmm. But that's it's a concept album primarily about the South. I don't think it did very well. Reviews weren't so good. I don't think it sold all that well. But thinking about that leads me into Petty's relationship with MTV. Which is a really interesting one. There continues to be this idea that to succeed in the first decade of MTV, you had to be gorgeous. Before you and I started recording, we were talking about Phil Collins, who was nobody's idea of a sex symbol. Neither was Huey Lewis, neither was ZZ Top. Now, standards were different for men and for women. It was easier to be a guy, as it is in society. It was easier to be a guy on MTV who wasn't great-looking. Mm-hmm. But Petty, for all his purism, knew that MTV was going to be a fantastic marketing device. So my co-author, Craig Marks, interviewed Petty for our MTV book, and Petty said he hated making videos, which almost all the guys who'd started bands in the early to late 70s had. The difference was, REO Speedwagon hated making videos and made shitty videos. Petty hated making videos, but as long as we got to make them, let's make them great so that we can be on this gigantic TV radio station and everyone around the country will see our songs at the same time. It's a little bit like Nirvana, who again seem like the sort of band that would have hated MTV, but played ball with them a lot.
I really like that you said that, because when I think about, yeah, I think about the videos that all Free Fallin' could come on today, or you could go to YouTube and see it, and it looks different than so many of the ones like Men at Work's Down Under has been derided. There's a number one single that introduced them to North America, and it's terrible. It's terribly shot, and I can't remember who said it, and I if it's from your book, I apologize, because someone said, basically, they just mime out every single lyric. Here's a guy having a Vegemite sandwich, and we'll show a guy having a Vegemite sandwich. So they don't hold up. And if you were playing MTV Classic, you'd choose a Petya video before you would choose that, or the Stones preening around in Start Me Up, looking like they're like Bill Wyman and Charlie Watts want to end their lives by just having the camera on them, right?
Petty was very proud of the videos. I can't remember which video it was that they did sort of a desert western. I think maybe it was You Got Lucky. But he made a point of saying, Michael Jackson ripped that one off. There was another video. He said, oh, yeah, the police ripped us off on that video, too. So he was proud of it. And there is a little bit of a workmanship aspect to that. If you have to make a video, make one that you can be proud of, that you worked hard on, as opposed to one that you laughed your way through because you're dismissing it.
What I love too is the use of, I have my own, synth bands. I'm from that sort of, I love the new romantic band. So if you give me Duran Duran and the Human League, I can find a lot there. But he used the keyboard a lot. And you've probably got buddies, loosely, I'd say. And I've got buddies who are like, puh, keyboards are for pussies. Give me guitars. And Tom,
I don't hang out with people.
I try not to. I think that they no. wander around my office, and I don't have the authority to get rid of them. That's the best way to
off my friend list instantly.
They should be for me also. So, but they think that, and they're like, "Yeah, Pete Townsend smashing guitars." I'm like, "Who's next?" Is almost all based on keyboard stuff that Pete Townsend was noodling around with. But Petty, unlike, and obviously Springsteen would do this with Roy Bittan, you're not going to hear a lot of keyboard in those sort of Heartland Mellencamp songs or a lot of those Seeger songs, unless it's a piano. Somehow the piano's okay with these Budweiser drinking dudes and a synthesizer isn't. But Tom seemed to really, you mentioned Don't Come Around Here No More, or you got Lucky almost sounds new wave for 1983, because that's what everyone was doing then.
Yeah. I was having this discussion with friends of mine on Facebook this morning, and I really was expecting someone to try to punch me in the face through the computer screen. There are bits of Damn the Torpedoes that come really close to disco in the rhythm section.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is part of what made Jimmy Iovine and his engineer so great on that record. They really brought out the rhythm section. Petty was a traditionalist. He was clear about what tradition he was working in. But he also knew that tradition was pretty expansive. Guitar, rock and roll, the band was a guitar, rock and roll band with two keyboard players. There are probably other examples I could think of if I'd had my coffee this morning. Mm. And Petty, it actually bothered me a little that Petty was so devoted to tradition. The one time I interviewed him was in 2013, and he was about to go on tour, and he decided that he was going to kick a lot of the hits off of his touring set. He didn't want to be a human jukebox anymore. He knew that it made the fans happy, but Damn the Torpedoes, I'm going to do what I want to do.
Hmm.
And he was playing smaller venues. So he did, there were nights when he wouldn't play Free Fallin' or Learning to Fly or Refugee. And I looked at the set lists. There were nights when he was playing, I don't know if it was Louie Louie or 96 Tears or old rock songs, in lieu of playing his own songs, because these were the songs he loved, and he didn't want people to forget about them. And he considered, I was going to say he considered Louie Louie as good as any of his songs, but Louie Louie is the best song of all time, so it's not really a comparison. He wanted the joy of playing those old songs, and he also wanted his fans to have the joy of hearing them.
Well, you and I are unfamiliar with that balancing act because being an artist, such a successful, what we'd call a Hall of Fame artist, and having 30 years of material, I just find you're damned if you do. If you play all hits, then someone says, oh, nostalgia act. And if you try and go, here's a couple for my new album, people head to the concession stand and they don't have the most times they don't have the petty balance that to somewhat where it's not. It's not Journey, and it's not Foreigner, and it's not, and there's nothing wrong with that. If those guys embrace playing this, and Def Leppard, if those guys embrace playing the same 18 songs, and if you and I made Pyromania and Hysteria, we'd probably have 90% of our songs mm-hmm. from those albums. That's what we would do, right?
Well, there is a middle ground somewhere. You look at the Stones are on tour right now. If you look at those set lists, it's hit, 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 hit. Two new songs, everybody goes to get beer. Hit, 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 hit. If it's 22 songs, it's basically their 20 biggest hits, and then two songs so that everybody gets a bathroom break. One guy who I think is doing it a little bit right is Billy Joel.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Billy Joel, and I get into every Billy Joel argument on the internet, God help me. I'd probably be a lot more productive if I could let this go. I've seen Billy Joel a lot. I don't ever need to hear him sing Piano Man again. When he sings Piano Man, it's like the Stones doing his two new songs. I go to the bathroom, I go to get a beer.
But would you like new music? Would you like new Billy Joel? Or are you good that you have enough Billy Joel to go on that because he's really not going to make new music again, you're good with that?
I would love new Billy Joel, but I've come to grips with the fact that there never will be any. But what he started to do is a similar thing to what Petty did, album tracks. You go to hear Billy Joel now, he'll play Stiletto, which is a great song but wasn't a single. And I think there is room for a lot of that in touring. And as you say, nobody always goes home happy. You can be a jukebox the way the Stones are and try to make everyone happy. Or you can decide, as Petty did on this 2013 tour, that the audience loves you because of the decisions that you've made. And if you make a decision that might displease them, they'll either decide they can go along with you or they won't. And so what? If you don't like it, go see a Mellencamp show.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so eager to talk about the Rock Hall with you, but I will tell you that once a year, and I don't know why, I go into this rabbit hole where I watch it's not even a rabbit hole. I watch that Billy Joel meltdown in Russia during Sometimes a Fantasy, and someone on the internet broke it down about a month ago, and they're like, "You realize the preciseness where he gets the lyrics all right, and he's screaming about stop lighting the audience. Let me do my. He gets it in between the verse while he's smashing different instruments. It's an amazing 90 seconds to watch. You probably watched it several times also.
He's an incredible musician. He's one of the few guys I've seen never miss a note. If something goes wrong on stage, somebody's guitar is out of tune and he has to transpose a song, he can do it instantly. It's incredible. But I've one of my New Year's resolutions was I'm going to stop defending Billy Joel. Because he can't persuade anyone. No one listening to us right now who this morning thought Billy Joel sucked is suddenly going to say, this idiot is right.
I guess not,
but someone
noted how Petty, last thing on Petty, never really had an uncool phase. And someone noted how Mellencamp, you'd look and go, oh, that's kind of schlocky. And Springsteen, even with the two solo albums away from the Eat Street Band, you're like, oh, we didn't think that was right. But Petty never really had that, and obviously no commercial sellouts. Like even Mellencamp criticized Bob Seger for selling out, and then all of a sudden there's Mellencamp songs in car commercials 10 years later. So eventually you're sucked in by the machine, and Tom Petty never really was, right?
Yeah, again, damn the torpedoes. Petty was not going to be dissuaded from doing what he wanted to do.
Yeah, Yeah, it's just a remarkable career and legacy. All right, you. By the way, if you haven't read Rob's book, I Want My MTV, along with Craig Marks, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution. I mentioned it's out there. It's great. I mentioned it's probably one of about 12 books near my bedside table. And I'll so like even I know this for a fact, and it just occurred to me I should tell you. 3 weeks ago, I just read like the Billy Squier chapter. That's it. People must come to you all the time, and it's because it's so cringeworthy. You're like, no, don't do it. And that's another. You started listening to the radio, and The Stroke was one of the big hit singles. So you're like, oh my God, this is Billy Squier is so great. And 3 years later, then there's that video. I Want My MTV. Go ahead.
I will tell you because you reminded me of this. The book got a lot of great reviews. You know, those are wonderful. If it helps sell books, then we're even happier. The biggest compliment we got, our book editor, was talking to a writer for The Simpsons and was seeing if this Simpsons writer wanted to do a book. And when the writer found out that our editor had edited the MTV book, he said, oh, my God, we keep that book on the Simpsons writer's table. It's on the table in the writer's room, and whenever we're bored or frustrated, we pick it up and we open to a random page and we read out loud some story about a midget or a hooker or cocaine, and we all laugh and then we feel better and we go back to work.
That's all it takes, is it? Okay, so that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. There's 19 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees this year, and I try and maintain some level of decorum, but I geek out about this kind of stuff. And you've written extensively about the ins, the outs, who's getting overlooked, who may have had too easy a ride into the Rock Hall. Anything strike your fancy this year? I find it fascinating, and I'll list some of the names in a bit, that an act can just get like Bon Jovi's been nominated twice in 2011 and 18, and you're going, what happened in the 6 years where they didn't? Or there's like a huge push for the Cars getting, they feel Journey-esque in their 3 straight years of getting nominated. Depeche Mode gets their second in a row. What jumps off the page at, we're seeing a lot of these sort of new wave artists. The Eurythmics are nominated for the first time ever, and you're going, my God, they've been eligible for 12 years. What appeals to you about this list?
Well, first of all, I should say that I'm a voter.
Yes,
you know, people should know that that informs my opinions and my ideas about how the process works. There's a discrepancy. There's a real problem in the Hall of Fame voting. The ballot that you and I are both looking at and talking about, that was composed by a nominating committee. The Hall of Fame nominating committee meets in secret once a year. It's 15 to 20, mostly men, mostly white men, and they put together a list of who they want the voters to vote on. Now, the voting block is more than 900 people. It includes morons like me. It includes anyone who's in the Hall of Fame automatically gets to vote. And what has happened year after year after year is the nominating committee puts forth a pretty good ballot that's got, you know, some crap on it, and also some fantastic bands, and the voters overlook the fantastic bands. You know, you asked what jumps out about me. The first thing that jumps out is Chic isn't on the list.
Yeah.
Chic had been put forth by the nominating committee 11 years in a row, and 11 times in a row, the voters didn't vote for Chic. I did. There weren't enough votes for them to get in. So I think the nominating committee finally said, all right, screw you guys. You're making us look bad, so we're not even going to give you the chance to make us look bad.
Interesting. So there are acts. Give me an example like the Moody Blues, which are, I don't know if they're, like, my inclination is no. You don't have to tell me which way you'd go, but it's the first year they've been nominated, and they've been eligible for close to 30 years, and certainly nothing in that body of work since then. I think there was an album in the early 90s I listened to called Keys to the Kingdom, but there's nothing in that 30-year body of work where I'd go, this tilts the case one way or the other, right? Like, most of these artists, some of them have, Depeche Mode's an example where they still keep putting out new albums, but most of these artists have stopped recording, basically, forever, right?
I think so. I don't entirely understand how the nominating committee decides who to nominate. I don't understand why Janet Jackson was on the list in the past, but isn't right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear to me. I think they try to come up with an assortment, a variety of older, younger, different eras, different decades, different styles, black, white, male, female. And then they just have to cross their fingers that the voters will do the right thing. Now, there is the thing you always have to keep in mind when you think about the Hall is it's a broadcast. It's a TV show. So if the looking at this list of nominees, let's say the Rock Hall, let's say the acts who got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year were Link Wray, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Nina Simone, The Meters, and Kate Bush. Who would watch that show?
Members of Kate Bush's family would be she's very reclusive. She's more reclusive than anybody in our business. Let's put it that way.
So they're not just creating a Rock Hall. They're creating a TV show that creates revenue that supports the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I've written about this before. Anybody who wants to know my full thoughts about the Rock Hall of Fame can go look at a piece I wrote in Billboard a couple of years ago. I'm not suggesting or implying that improper approaches are taken. I'm not suggesting that the Rock Hall lies about who won and who didn't, although I wish that, like the Baseball Hall of Fame, they made those votes public.
Right.
I'm not sure why they don't. It seems to me that being less secretive about it would make everyone feel a lot better. But I do think it serves their purposes if, for instance, Rush gets in and the Meters don't.
Hmm. And there's always that. We've had some drama recently. We had the Steve Miller Black Keys drama. Right? That was drama.
Mm-hmm.
GNR gets in. Will Axel show up? He did not. And at that moment, you're going, well, there's certainly not going to be a reunion tour 16 months from now, but there was. And even Journey last year, you're going, I watched the behind the music. There's some tightness there. There's some tension still, obviously, about how it all ended with Steve Perry, but it was the first thing I went to on my PVR to see what they said about each other, how they were together. You're right. It's a TV show and you need that element there, don't you? We would see that certainly with Rage Against the Machine to some extent. If we'd be like, what will they say? Especially in 2017, we'd be quite. I saw Tom Morello on Bill Maher's show the other night. We'd be quite curious what kind of statement they'd make, right?
I think that if you want to predict who's going to get in on the ballot, this works really reliably. Figure out who the two or three biggest rock bands are. So I don't know if you can go to Vegas and bet on the Rock Hall of Fame. I would bet that Dire Straits get in this year. I would almost bet my 5-year-old son's life that Radiohead gets in, because they check all the boxes.
Yeah,
they've had a long career. They're credible. They have had some amount of commercial success, and most of all, they're going to bring people in to watch the TV show.
So wager on Kate Bush. I think we got your subtle message.
Short coming. Kate Bush. Go short on Kate Bush. Go long on. So who do I think are the short things on this list? Give me 1 second.
Yeah.
I think Dire Straits are a sure thing. I think the Cars will get in this year. I think LL Cool J will get in because it's good to have a rapper. I don't mean that was a bad way of saying it. They want to be inclusive.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Radiohead gets in. Rage Against the Machine gets in. I don't have any particular feel for Nina Simone, Sister Rosetta, and Link Wray. I don't really know which of the older acts the voters will honor. And I am also close to 100% that Bon Jovi doesn't get in on, I think it's the first time they were nominated. It's like the Baseball Hall of Fame, where, who recently got in with you know, 97% of the vote. There are voters who look at, you know, this guy hit 315 and 500 home runs and however many RBIs. I off the top of my head, what's an impressive number of RBIs? 1,500?
Oh, sure. Yeah. 100 for 15 years. Oh, my gosh. Sure. Yeah. 1,300. Sure. Yeah.
But there are still sports writers who won't vote for the guy because it's first ballot.
Yeah, we always do that. Who are the guys that left George Brett or Nolan Ryan or Robin Yount off their first ballot? Who are the people, who are the ad wizards that decided to do that, right? That's what we're wondering.
Yes, that's what I mean, except that Bon Jovi isn't Robin Yount. You know, if you were...
Or Wade Boggs, yes.
If you were going to let Bon Jovi into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which, God, I hope they won't, unless the band buys a ticket, then you wouldn't do it on the first ballot. You'd make them wait, certainly the way you made the Stooges wait, or the Sex Pistols.
I've so monopolized your time, but I can't go without you telling you how disappointing it was to see the Cars reunion tour. Like, I love the integrity of the Cars, but I can't. Ben Orr was so unbelievably missed. Had I known how I felt watching them on stage without him, because I never got to see them in their heyday, I never would have gone. I just... Now, Rick Ocasek is low energy. I got that. But to see him step up and sing Let's Go, to see him sing just what I needed. And he wrote those. They're his songs. But he knew he didn't want to be the front man for 100% of the shows when he did them. And he knew Ben had a real, real good voice. Not an undeniable voice, but a good voice. It was tough. I'm trying to think of an act where I've seen that someone's... I made the mistake of going to an NXS show post-Michael Hutchence with that guy. Exactly. And you're like, this was one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made. And you feel guilty about it. You feel guilt. Isn't that amazing?
I don't know if this will make you feel any better, but Ben Orr was one of the chillest dudes I've ever met. Like, chill to the point of almost being lackadaisical.
Wait, when did you get to meet him? Was he sick already, or was he...
Oh, no.
Okay, good.
No,
okay.
It was years ago when he made a solo album.
With Stay the Night on it. I love that album.
Yeah. I think if you had said to Ben... Listen, man, one day your band is going to go on tour without you. They're going to have a really huge reunion tour. Ocasek is going to sing the songs that you sang, and they're going to call themselves the Cars, and you're not in the band. He would have said, okay. And that would have been the end of it. But there is this question of when is a reunited band not the real band? I know people who refused to go see the Replacements, or said that they weren't going to go see the Replacements, because it was Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson, but not Bob Stinson.
That's an amazing stand. That's an amazing hill to die on, I think. That's not exactly Roger Waters is not in Pink Floyd, I'm not going. That's not that, is it? That's not that at all, is it?
But my point is, everyone has an arbitrary set of distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
I will go see the Replacements happily without Bob Stinson and without Chris Mars. Would I go see Journey without Steve Perry? No.
No, me neither.
And you can say, well, the difference is the lead singer. But there are bands where I'll go see them even if the lead singer isn't in the band anymore, because I didn't care that much about the singer.
Can you do Styx without Dennis DeYoung? Or have you? I haven't, but I don't know if I could, even given the possibility. Obviously, the fact I haven't may answer that question right there.
I probably wouldn't do Styx with Dennis DeYoung. Although, I might be slightly more inclined to go without him, because then I wouldn't have to hear Lady.
What if it was a Kilroy was here 30th anniversary tour and it was all robots and Tommy Shaw wanted to smash DeYoung in the head with his guitar?
I have to ask one clarifying question. Is my weed dealer in town?
Heavier than that. We're going a lot. That's a gateway drug for this particular reunion tour, I think.
I think I would have to skip a Kilroy reunion tour unless one of my editors was paying me to go. This was like, by the way, you know, I used to work at this music magazine, Blender.
Yes, I know it. Yeah.
When we were bored, which was often, we used to play this game called How Much Money. How much money would someone have to pay you to go see Styx with Dennis DeYoung playing the Kilroy album? How much would you have to? How much would someone have to pay you to go to? And there are a lot of variables. Who are the other bands?
Uh-huh.
Who are the other bands on the bill? Where is the show? So, you know, how much would someone have to pay me to go see Bon Jovi at Madison Square Garden is less money than seeing Bon Jovi at Giant Stadium.
I feel like I played this game also, but the caveat is it's in a suite and food and drink are free, because then that really ups the ante for what you would tolerate, given people fall over each other with a T-shirt cannon at baseball games.
But that's cheating. and the other term is you have to stay for the whole show.
That's really tricky.
You can't skip the opening act. So, you know, we would say to one another, okay, Bon Jovi is on tour with Winger. How much would somebody have to pay you to go see that show? $800. $800. So you wouldn't do it for $750? Yeah, I'd do it for $750. Then that's $800 isn't the answer. It's got to be not $1 less.
This sounds sexist. This is a great set. I should write a book that says that and see if it sells or if I get fired.
It would.
And I'd get fired. It would sell and I would lose my job. So, six in one and a half dozen the other. We do this game. We don't have a WNBA team here. And I wish we did, because I don't have a daughter, but I wish people could go. It's great. There was one in Detroit when I worked there. Would you rather your WNBA team in your city won the the New York Liberty won the title, or would you rather have $20 cash? And I think asking New York, there would be great debate, because there's some civic pride, and $20, like, you can go to Subway a couple times. We're not setting you up with a car payment. But the WNBA team would provide happiness for the women that won, for the people that would go. I don't know. That seems like you could do this with the MLS, I suppose, too, and other leagues, I suppose. So
that question touches me deeply, because my three teams, the three teams that I live and die for, are the Mets, the Knicks, and the Jets. So if you or your listeners want to know how I became such an asshole or so cynical or so despairing or have such problems with depression, the Knicks, the Mets, and the Jets. And so the similar question that I play with sometimes is, if I could give a championship to one of those teams, which would it be? And I agonize.
Well, you've seen the Mets. I mean, and listen, the Mets were in the World Series 2 years ago. And, I mean, so that's something.
The answer
it has to be the Jets. It's been since Joe Namath. You have to be in the Super Bowl. Even if you lose 42-7, you have to see your team play in it.
I think the answer I come up with is usually the Knicks, because you're right. I have seen the Mets win a World Series. They also, I believe, are likely to get back to a World Series in my lifetime. The Knicks are so ruined and disastrous and cursed that only a miracle or divine intervention is going to get them into, I mean, never mind the finals, the playoffs.
Well, this is James. Do you feel it's inevitable? Like, I lived in Detroit, and they're like, as long as the Ford family owns the Lions, it was the one constant that just people, doesn't matter, Barry Sanders can play there, Calvin Johnson can play there. Can you not get past James Dolan? I mean, forget his stints opening for the Eagles. Please do. But you can't. Until he announces it's not his team anymore. We went through this with an owner named Harold Ballard in Toronto with the Maple Leafs. And until he passed away in 19, now they haven't won anyway in 50 years. The Knicks are often the Leafs, where the tickets sell, nobody doesn't go, it's still the hotbed, it's still the hottest ticket in the city, and you're like, based on results, why, right? It's got to be James Dolan based for you.
Every Knicks game is sold out.
Yeah.
Anytime you go to the Garden, tonight's attendance is 19,763 people. I have the number memorized. If I'm wrong about it, I'll be really embarrassed. He has no. The team is worth at least $2 billion. He has no real motivation to change what he's doing. I mean, that's not exactly it, because he did change what he's doing. He fired Phil Jackson. The biggest downside for James Dolan is that people loathe him. But he's a guy like Trump, whom he's friends with,
yeah.
who seems to thrive off being hated. You know, and you bring up the issue of ownership. I mean, my three teams, the Mets, the Knicks, the Jets, three of the 10 worst owners in all of sports.
Yeah.
How did I, if I had a time machine, I would go back to 8-year-old me and say, psst, root for the Yankees.
I can't, so we had Colin Quinn from Saturday Night Live on. He's a Jets Mets guy. He was in town for, yeah. just for laughs. And he echoed what I said after week two of the NFL season. I don't know what I would do as a Jets fan if the Jets go, say, 5-11 this year and somehow are pleasant.
Oh, God.
But, and the Giants, wait, the Giants go 1-15 and get the number one pick and get a,
right.
get Sam Darnold from USC for the next 15 years. Like, that's so unfair. It's not even funny, isn't it?
I would say that would be the Jetsiest thing of all time. But that would be the 400th time I've said that would be the Jetsiest thing of all time. You know, was the butt fumble the Jetsiest thing of all time? Was having the 56th guy on a 53-man roster break Geno Smith's jaw when he was winning the
yes.
quarterback competition in training camp the Jetsiest thing of all time? Was Joe Namath being drunk on the halftime show and all but molesting the female reporter, the Jetsiest thing of all time? I don't know. Was drafting, which one of them? Was it Johnny Lamb Jones, the receiver they drafted in the first round who was blind in one eye? Was that the Jetsiest thing of all time?
I know I saw one. I was a Dolphins fan as a kid. I still am, I suppose, although that's not going great either. And they played a Monday night game, and I need to know if you remember this. And they were killing the Jets at the time. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the booth, and it's like 31-7 Miami. And they interview I don't know what Arnold's promoting then. This is way before he's governor. It's way before. It's like 2000 or 2001. And he says, the Jets will come back. They will come back and win this. And Wayne, he kept calling him Wayne Krebeck. Not Wayne Krebet with a T, but Beck with a CK. Wayne Krebeck will be the hero, I am telling you. I promise you. Believe me now, hear me later. All that Hans and Franz stuff. And they tie the game, and then Krebeck catches the winning touchdown in overtime. And you're like, I couldn't believe I saw Arnold Schwarzenegger forecast that. Couldn't believe it.
Isn't that the game that they called the Monday Night Miracle, or was that the fake spike game?
That's the Monday Night Miracle, because, no, Marino did the fake spike, and that Miami won, but Jumbo Elliott, the lineman, caught a touchdown
yeah.
pass on a tackle-eligible
yeah.
play in that game to beat the Dolphins on Monday. That's a great memory that there were both those games, but yeah.
The Jets have aside from all the other things wrong with them, they shit the bed only on the grandest of stages. Their record on Monday Night Football, I mean, I was trying to Google it just a minute ago. I can't find it quickly. They, inevitably, the worst game of the year they play on Monday Night Football. They make themselves a laughing stock, and the most laughing stock thing they could do this year would be to have a decent season.
That's right.
And I decided that I was going to boycott the Jets again this year, partly because I've given too many Sundays of my life to watching these morons, and partly because Woody Johnson is a huge Trump supporter, and I don't want to do anything that puts even a micro penny in Woody Johnson's pocket. But I noticed on Twitter that the Jets were playing pretty well last Sunday, and I also had mixed feelings because now, you know, Trump wants us to boycott football. Well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That's right.
So
yes.
If Trump wants me to boycott football, isn't it my obligation to watch football?
You should watch 11 straight hours of it to piss him off. Yeah, anything that works.
So I turned on the Jets game and was rooting against them in overtime. Missed the field goal. When McCown threw a pass to Bilal Powell that they ruled a lateral, and it went for a defensive touchdown, I was cheering.
Yeah. Yeah.
These guys have to lose. And by the way, as pathetic or meaningless as it may be, my minor protest against Trump was literally, the TV in our bedroom, I turned it on football, and left the room and was gone for hours and then came back home and switched it to the 4 o'clock game.
Just now, do you have a ratings box? Or are you hoping that you a small voice among 340 million Americans counted, and that way he couldn't criticize how badly the ratings were, the failing NFL, of course.
I'm not clear on how ratings work these days. It seems to me that maybe in the digital age, every box that's on gets registered somehow.
Maybe, yeah.
But I may be completely wrong about that.
Well, it's the 2-2 Jets this weekend at the 0-4 Browns. At the 0-4 Browns. I mean, so you could have a winning football team heading into the October 15th weekend. There's that to consider.
If you had said to me that after 4 weeks the Jets and the Patriots would have the same record,
no.
I would have said, so Tom Brady died in a car crash?
I got bad news. They might have a better record. New England plays at Tampa tonight, and the Jets are at the lowly Browns. So, I mean, there's hope.
These stupid heads don't even know how to lose.
They,
right?
Didn't,
they don't even know suck for Sam. Isn't that what?
Suck for Sam. And you can't ask, I always say this on the air, you can't ask players and coaches not to try, but you can strip the assets down enough. And they've tried so that you make sure that you're, the Knicks have endeavored to do that at different points in time the last couple of years. Now, you got to concur, without Carmelo, this should be an excellent season to go for the first overall pick. Carmelo was just too good, scored too many points on 20, 25 nights a year that they were never going to get to the absolute basement, right? Couldn't do it.
And mostly people who aren't New Yorkers say, well, you can't rebuild in New York. The fans won't stand for it. The Knicks have been rebuilding for 20 years. They've been rebuilding ever since Patrick Ewing. They just haven't known that they were rebuilding.
Bingo.
We were talking about their owner, James Dolan, a minute ago. If the Knicks ever won a championship under Dolan, he would be the most popular man since Fiorello LaGuardia. They would name buildings after him.
You'd land.
I would give, if the Knicks ever win a championship in James Dolan's ownership, I will kiss him with tongue.
So this goes back to your blender argument, is whether you would ever tolerate a Knicks championship if for the rest of your life you had to land after a flight with your family at James Dolan Airport. I don't. You got a real quid pro quo there. You really do. That's not that. We're not going to name an airport after David Letterman, which we should. We're going to name it after James Dolan. Come on. For New York, please.
But I always want clarifying answers. How old am I when they win this championship? Because if I'm 92, then it's just not worth it.
How bad is the service at Dolan Airport, and how delayed are the flights, and how overpriced are the cabin seats? You got to consider all that stuff, really.
How crappy is the food, and most of all, how bad is the music? Because it's nothing but James Dolan and his band.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they're not exactly playing the long run all the way through on the flight over the loudspeakers. I have monopolized so much of your time, but this was great. And your thoughts on Tom Petty? We're gonna look for them on Billboard Online later in the week. I'll let people know where to find it. Yeah,
great. Yes, please do.
Rob, that was a great chat. Thank you so much for doing that. Our listeners are going to really, really enjoy it. There's nobody I'd rather talk music with, and it's tough circumstances. But I found that with Prince and with Bowie, and you probably did too. Some of these things are inevitable, and when you lose a great artist, it's awesome to have a community to talk about it with people for the immediate future. We're still doing it with David Bowie and Prince and Leonard Cohen and many of these other amazing artists, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the few good things that we can find about social media. The people who grieved about Bowie and Prince, you know, maybe it's just the people I know. There seemed to be more grief about the two of them. It certainly helped that people who were grieving were able to find one another so easily. Mm.
Thank you again for doing this. We really do
appreciate
it. Always
a pleasure, Greg. Anytime you want.
Rob Tannenbaum joining us. We'll let people know when his Tom Petty piece hits billboard.com. But he's writing about the legacy of the late, great 66-year-old rock and roller who, as we mentioned, just finished a 40-year anniversary tour. I didn't go this year. But did end up going, I want to say, 3 years ago, and saw him on, I guess, what would be called the Hypnotic Eye Tour at the Air Canada Center. And he had Steve Winwood opening. mean, think about that. Steve Winwood was at his commercial peak in 1986. Huge album with Back in the High Life, and Tom Petty just felt like he was sort of there, right? Sort of struggling along. And not that they're rivals or anything, but the tables turn, they stay contemporaries, and then boom, just like that, it's your circumstances change and you're opening for the other guy. That's life sometimes, isn't it? Just a quick thought on this Cam Newton thing. We'll see where this goes the rest of the week, but Cam got in some trouble answering a question from a Charlotte Observer reporter, Jordan Rodriguez. Here's the question. Cam, I know you take a lot of pride in seeing your receivers play well. Devin Funchess has seemed to really embrace the physicality of his routes and getting those extra yards. Does that give you a little bit of enjoyment to see him kind of truck-sticking people out there? Now, Newton was smiling. And now I knew he'd done something wrong before I saw the clip, so maybe that prejudiced my clip about Cam. And the second that she said the word routes, Newton started to get a smile on his face. And I found that a little bit strange. And the bottom line is, it was a stay in your lane moment, right? This is LeVar Ball telling a woman, which he did with on Fox Sports 1 with Christine Leahy, stay in your lane. You talk about what you know about, and what you know about is not football. And so that being said, the room just didn't capitulate to Cam. And I've seen it before with athletes who get mad at a reporter. And I have been that reporter, or I have been that host. And like lots of people like, hey, you think Dave Nonis did a bad job with his leaf trade? Why don't you yell at him on the air and tell him that he's done a really crappy job? Because there's an element of professionalism that you have to maintain. You can ask. You can ask the question. Happy with this signing? Worried this isn't going to work out? Is this too much money for this player? Can't be insulting. You can't be belittling. Because guess what? When the shoe's on the other foot, and it was in this Cam Newton exchange, it's not funny. It's not funny in the least. And I don't doubt that a lot of women have been through stories like this to some extent, but the concept is it's supposed to be happening less and less. And there's supposed to be some element of accountability and some if for people who treat people equal, and there have to be some people who feel that shame when they get this so wrong. And this wasn't a guy backed into a corner. This wasn't a guy after a loss, a guy after having to, you know, let a defensive coordinator go, a coach who's upset because the journalist does not understand and isn't asking a good question. I've heard bad questions. If I put my hand up every time I heard a bad question on television, on radio, in locker rooms, in press conferences, you wouldn't believe it. But it's live, and generally speaking, these questions aren't scripted, and I don't blame guys for turning on the media sometimes. There's a way to handle it respectfully, right? So that it's not a physically threatening moment either. I just didn't get this one. It was a football question. It was a reasonable question. She's asking you a professional question in this particular verbal exchange. And Cam Newton turned it into a sexist punch to the gut. Because that's what it's meant to be. It's meant to make her feel bad. It's meant to be notable that she's out of her element. And I can buy the concept, and I always have. If you played to a certain level on something, we all feel like we have some expertise on something based on what we've done before. And we all feel like there's elements where we're like, oh, you're the expert here. Let me shine the light on you. You know about more of this than me. And this can happen in my capacity, and this can happen with anything you do. Could be with cars, could be with cooking, could be with travel, could be with raising kids. You can have somebody who's never been a father or mother tell you how to parent. You probably aren't, and you probably don't want another parent telling you how you should do it, because the kid experience, your kid is so independent and unique, they may not be able to relate to what you are doing, what you're going through, and thus these are just arguments people end up having. Hell, parents, my own wife, who's amazing, and I have had disputes, mild ones, very few, about parenting and should we do this or should we do that? And we both might be really adamant about the route to go with doing it a certain way. Bottom line, this was a really bad moment for Cam Newton. And I worry because this wasn't flying off the handle. This is how he feels. This is who he is and how he feels. And when Rodriguez wrote on her Twitter account, I spoke with him after and it was worse. I chose not to share because I have an actual job to do today and one he will not keep me from. Oh my goodness. There's going to be some fallout from this, and I'm not the type. I'm not the type to just tell you how sensitive I feel about something or demonstrate that I'm just a great guy and I care about this so much and I care about it more than you do. But it's a really bad moment and it's a really regretful scenario. And Cam Newton should know that if we were as backward as his thoughts are on women in sports media, we'd be right back to where we were, where people of his color can't be a quarterback. And that'd be wrong, where someone who's black says, I want to be quarterback. Yeah, that's great. How's receiver sound? Ask Warren Moon. Ask Doug Williams. Ask people of that generation how difficult it was. Bad game would come. You still didn't even know if you'd keep your job. And Cam Newton's a $100 million quarterback, and nobody gives it a second thought. Nobody gives it a second thought. You can question a lot of things. But you can't question his ability, his talent, his accomplishments in college. He's taken a team to the Super Bowl. He's won Super Bowl MVP. And we'd say this whether this was Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Cam Newton, or Matt Ryan saying it. This is not a black-white issue. This is a respect issue. Interested to see where it goes. We hope that you enjoyed today's podcast. Rob Tannenbaum was kind enough to be our guest. Carolyn will be back next week. I will talk to you on Brady and Price, of course, on Sportsnet 590 The Fan at 5:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. Coming on a day very soon. Please rate our podcast on iTunes. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week.
You've been listening to Point Taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady on sportsnet.ca/590.